This is number 0024, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Yes, it is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0024. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File, we'll meet Judy Mandel, the author of Replacement Child. How would you feel if your parents had you as a replacement after losing a previous child?
I always felt like I was kind of the outsider. I came in second act is what I always felt like, because I missed that defining moment of their lives. And so it followed that I tried to be kind of the healing factor in all of their lives, which carried on to the rest of my life. So I wasn't the one that needed special care like my sister, or the one to be worried over. And Replacement Child goes into how I was fashioned into an actual replacement for Donna for a while. And then how my father's resentment over losing her and being left with me affected my relationship with men, especially for years to come, and how I perceived my own version of self-worth.
Alexandre Philippe is a filmmaker who has made a documentary called The People vs. George Lucas. Where does the title of this film come from?
When you're a Star Wars fan and you find yourself in another room with another Star Wars fan, you start talking about the things that you love and the things that you hate. And of course, at the center of this discussion, of this debate, is always George Lucas. And so the title, essentially really this whole concept came to me with the title, The People versus George Lucas, because there's so much, you know, what I call love-hate for the man. It's been going on for decades now, you know, especially obviously since the release of the special edition.
We'll hear from Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
Oh boy, am I ready to rip into something right now.
Allegedly, of course. Hi, this is Steve Walsh, you know, your guy in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. You're going to want to stick around for my two-minute tirade. It's coming up later on, right here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. The guests later on this edition of The Stuff File, the person who told you this was show number 0024, is legendary Montreal broadcaster Ted Bird. You can read his musings called Bird Droppings by going to his blog at tedbirddroppings.blogspot.com. That's tedbirddroppings.blogspot.com. And thank you very much, Ted, for doing the slate on this edition of The Stuff File. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? And first up on The Stuff File, Argentina's president recommended pork as an alternative to Viagra. Write your own double entendre, saying she spent a satisfied weekend with her husband after eating barbecued pork. Here's a quote from her. I've just been told something I didn't know, that eating pork improves your sex life. I'd say it's a lot nicer to eat a bit of grilled pork than take Viagra. That's the quote from President Cristina Fernandez, as she said this to leaders of the pig farming industry. What a surprise. She said she recently ate pork and that things went very well that weekend, so it could well be true. Argentines are the world's biggest per capita consumers of beef, but the government has sought to promote pork as an alternative in recent years due to the rising steak prices and as a way to diversify the meat industry. Trying it doesn't cost anything, so let's give it a go, Fernandez said in a televised speech. Wow. On to Berlin. A 76-year-old German man trying to thaw out his car incinerated it instead when he decided to speed things up by putting a blow heater under the hood. He burned the whole vehicle out completely, said a spokesperson for the police station in the western city of Hildesheim. Police said the man left the heater on next to the frozen windshield washer tank and returned indoors. Shortly afterward, he heard two explosions and returned to find the car ablaze. He alerted fire services, who arrived in time to prevent the flames from destroying his house, including charring of the building. Total damages were estimated at 40,000 euros. That's about $56,000 U.S. On to Peru. You never think this kind of thing happens, but it does. Peruvian doctors amputated the healthy leg of an 86-year-old man, then amputated the other leg when they realized their mistake. I was shocked when I lifted the sheets and saw they had taken his left leg, the man's daughter, Carmen Villanueva said. The ulcer was on his right leg, and they had to amputate that one to keep the infection from spreading, she said. The hospital in the coastal town of Callao, just north of Lima, said it had suspended the doctors in the botched surgery for the life-threatening ulcer, pending an investigation. You know, just a couple of years ago, 2 years ago, I had surgery on a leg, and I, no joke intended, actually joke intended, but I was also serious, I got a magic marker and wrote on my leg, "You are here," just to make sure they got the right one when they put me out. And by the way, it was the right one. Moving right along, we go to Houston. Fire department officials said an out-of-control inflatable gorilla was blamed for a rooftop blaze at a Houston shopping center. No injuries were reported in the fire. The remnants of the inflatable gorilla were seen at the site. District Chief Fred Hooker said some type of blow-up doll, and yes, I said Hooker and blow-up doll in the same sentence, and it had nothing to do with sex, was on the roof. The item deflated and landed on some lights leading to the fire. Fire authorities said two stores suffered minor water damage. Part of the rooftop was also seen to have suffered fire damage. Now this next story, has all the earmarks of a good Agatha Christie novel. It takes place in the sleepy English town of Crawley, and the good people there have a real serial killer on their hands. The only good news is he doesn't murder humans. Rather, he decapitates snowmen and then takes their heads. From neighborhood to neighborhood, the killer moves under cover of darkness and puts the chill on children's winter fun. And not just snowmen, snow women have fallen victim to this madman as well. The outraged citizens of Crawley are demanding that these crimes be stopped and hope the police can soon bring this menace to justice. Still, it's difficult to figure out what the charges would be, and all the evidence will soon be melted. Okay, in Alexandria, Louisiana, police stopped a 51-year-old man who was riding his bicycle at night without a headlight and carrying some kind of homemade weapon he fashioned from a butcher knife and a pool cue. And he had a razor blade in his hat. Plus, an officer patted him down and found a metal push rod that appeared to be used for smoking crack cocaine. And then there were the prescription painkillers in his pocket in someone else's name. In other words, this guy's pretty much toast. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File here with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we go to Poland. In Poland, 76-year-old beekeeper Josef Guzi was pronounced dead by a doctor after collapsing. So the body was placed in a coffin and getting ready to be prepared for burial. Fortunately, that's when Mr. Guzi's grieving widow made a final request and asked for her husband's necklace, which he was wearing at the time. So the undertaker went to remove it and found that the poor man still had a pulse. Upon closer examination, he was found to also be still breathing. So ironically, he was rushed to the hospital in the very same ambulance that had taken him to the funeral home. After several weeks of intensive care, he's now back at home taking care of his bees. Doctors are calling the precedent-setting incident a case of suspended animation, which I believe is really a nice way of saying, boy, did we screw up. Okay, on to our first guest on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. You know, most of us are comforted and strengthened to know that our parents had joyously welcomed us and had always treasured our individuality. Sadly, many others feel their parents weren't there for them. But what if you learned you were only born because your mother and father were grieving the loss of another child? On the line with us right now is Judy Mandel, who actually grew up knowing she was replacing a deceased sibling. She's the author of Replacement Child, and she joins us from Connecticut. Hi, Judy. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. How old were you when you realized this, or was this something you always knew?
Well, I guess I could best explain that is if you might remember times in your life when you thought you were lucky because because it happened to the other guy. You know, something always happened to the other guy, and I always thought that I was the one who was unscathed and untouched by and spared the aftermath of that plane crash that killed my older sister and nearly killed my other sister. Donna was the sister who was killed. She was 7. And Linda was my other sister. She was only 2. And she was the one who bore the brunt of that accident. That's what we always called it, the accident in the house. you know, from the explosion and the fire from the crash, Linda was burned over 80% of her body, and she was only two, so it was a very small body with third-degree burns, and she was in and out of the hospital for reconstructive surgeries once or twice a year for 20 years of her life. After that, my mom entered into a deep depression, and after losing her daughter, and the doctor recommended, as was common in those days, it was 1952, that she have another child to help her out of that depression. So that's when I came in, and when I was the replacement for Donna, and then it began, and that's why the name of the book is Replacement Child, and it's really a telling of my story within the larger family story. My parents and certainly my sister Linda had enormous challenges in overcoming that tragedy, both physically and emotionally. I always felt like I was kind of the outsider. I came in second act is what I always felt like, because I missed that defining moment of their lives. And so it followed that I tried to be kind of the healing factor in all of their lives, which carried on to the rest of my life. So, you know, that I wasn't the one that needed special care like my sister or the one to be worried over. And replacement child goes into how I was fashioned into an actual replacement for Donna for a while, and then how my father's resentment over losing her and being left with me affected my relationships with men, especially for years to come, and how I perceived my own version of self-worth.
Your sister was seven when she died. So in the first 7 years of your life, of your development, were you expected to be like your sister was?
Well, you know, I remember, you know, and you might remember too, a lot of the themes, even though this is a specific circumstance, I think a lot of people feel like, you know, why does everything I do end up disappointing someone? And I never knew the underlying reason that I was feeling that way, but was afraid to make a wrong move that would be misinterpreted by either my family or friends. And it was a delicate dance, you know, to please someone all the time. And really, I think when you read Replacement Child, you might even recognize a hidden promise in your own life and how it unconsciously affected your life. For me, I gave myself the promise to be everything my sister, who died from the crash, could never be, and everything my injured sister could either. Of course, I could never live up to that promise of my sister. How could anyone live up to a promise of a perfect memory and be a true replacement child? I could be a cheerleader for my sister, who was badly injured, and for my parents. I knew I needed to be that one that was, you know, easy to care for, as I said, and kind of the fixer in the family.
Are your parents still alive?
No, they're not. They're not. As a matter of fact, I started writing this after they passed away, and right before I published the book this summer, my sister Linda passed away, too. I was glad she was able to read the draft of the book, and she actually picked the cover for the book.
What did your sister Linda have to say about it?
Well, she actually liked the book. She argued a little bit about my portrait of my father in it, because I think different children have different parents, even though they're the same parents. They have a different relationship, and certainly in this case, you know, she had a completely different relationship with my father. And it, you know, one of the things that set me free was being able to acknowledge my anger at my father and being able to let go of that, which was a difficult thing. He was a wonderful man, and everyone loved him. My mother, my sister definitely didn't have the same relationship that I had with him, and I loved him. But recognizing that, and recognizing the anger that came from his distance from me, because he really couldn't reconcile that I was there and Donna was not, that helped me. And when I realized how, you know, deeply hurt he was after I wrote the book, or during writing the book, it really helped me to, you know, overcome and forgive him for anything that he had done to hurt me.
Well, how cathartic was writing this book for you?
It was extremely cathartic. And, you know, it was re-identifying the nature of relationships. And I think that that's at the heart of the kind of recovery that you read about in Replacement Child, that if you're always reacting to some past pattern from a parental relationship, you can't totally be present there for your partner, especially. And, you know, you can't really have any real communication. You know, like when I was a kid, I used to play dress up, and, you know, later I performed, I did music, and trying to earn my father's approval and love. And I didn't know he had made himself a promise. This was his own promise, not to give me too much attention, especially when my other sister, who was badly scarred from the crash and the fire, was within earshot. So, you know, as little girls usually do, I kept vying for that attention. And when I didn't get it, I withdrew from him. And that same pattern was repeated in my adult relationship. So, you know, you can see how that happens, I think,
Did you ever go through the yin and the yang of saying, I want this attention, I need this attention, that's what's the process of growing up, and on the other side saying, gee, am I being selfish because I want this attention, given the facts of what's going on in the dynamics of my family?
Oh yeah, that's why I could never even admit that I wanted the attention, because it was, in my view, a selfish thing. That, of course, my sister Linda needed a lot of attention, and I recognize that. So I think that served to further subterfuge, if you will, my feelings of wanting that attention.
When did the book come out?
The book came out this past fall in October.
And have you had the opportunity, either when writing the book or after the book has come out, of talking to people who are either exactly in your situation, being the replacement child, or to parents who may have done the same thing with their own children, unknowingly?
I have, and I was actually in the process of putting together some other stories of people, and had the opportunity to speak to some people who identify with that term replacement child as, you know, themselves. And usually it's later in life, because we don't think about it that's the case. But that's why that kind of underlying promise that you give yourself comes out later in your life. And I saw a lot of similarities between the people that I talked to and myself. And especially with issues of rejection and abandonment, those kind of issues. And I think that those are the kinds of things that are addressed in Replacement Child through my stories. So it was very enlightening to hear those stories. The parents are a bit different. Some of them don't like that term, replacement child, I find, and I can't blame them. I'm sure my parents would argue with me about it as well. But I think it helps to at least define some issues for people that they can then address by seeing themselves in that light.
The book is called Replacement Child. It's written by Judy Mandel. You could also check out her website, which is www.replacementchild.com. And the book is available on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, among other places. I thank you very, very much, Judy, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much.
Judy Mandel, author of Replacement Child. You can find more information at Judy's website, which is www.replacementchild.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is 0024, and you'll find the links to Judy's website, plus links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo, is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the filmmaker behind The People vs. George Lucas. We also have Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation, and of course, an idiot of the day. But right now, more stuff here on the Stuff File program. And we go to London for this next story. International hotel chain Holiday Inn is offering a trial human bedwarming service at 3 hotels in Britain this month. If requested, a willing staff member at 2 of the chain's London hotels and 1 in the northern English city of Manchester will dress in an all-in-one flea sleeper suit before slipping between the sheets. The new Holiday Inn bed warmers service is a bit like having a giant hot water bottle in your bed, according to a spokesperson. The bed warmer is equipped with a thermometer to measure the bed's required temperature of 20 degrees Celsius or 68 degrees Fahrenheit. Holiday Inn said the warmer would be fully dressed and leave the bed before the guest occupied it. They could not confirm if the warmer would shower first, but said hair would be covered. That's a good thing. Floris Evis, Holiday Inn spokeswoman, told Reuters that the innovative bed-warming method was in response to Britain's recent cold weather and marked the launch of 3,200 new Holiday Inns worldwide. She could not explain why the beds were not being warmed by hot water bottles or electric blankets, but admitted the human method was quirky. Now, I actually had the phone number of the spokesperson, and we were trying to get her on the program to talk to us, but they weren't returning our calls. I think they were too busy snuggling in bed or whatever it is they're doing. On to New York. New York City's transit agency is investigating a video posted online that shows a man kissing and snuggling a live chicken aboard a subway. The subway rider who took the video said last week that it was one of those New York moments she felt compelled to record. Kylie Kaiser, a 27-year-old architect from Brooklyn, and 2 friends boarded the Uptown No. 6 train at the 33rd Street station at around 7 p.m. This guy was on his back, rolling from side to side, kissing, hugging, and lifting the chicken into the air, she said. She said the man was oblivious to everything around him and didn't respond to onlookers. It was definitely an only in New York situation, said Kaiser, who moved to the city about 3 years ago from Tennessee. Kaiser said the man looked like he was homeless because he had a shopping cart next to him filled with cans and was wearing a shirt with the MTA patch that looked like he had found it somewhere. New York City Transit spokesperson Charles Seaton said no passengers reported the incident. He said only service animals and those in containers are permitted in the subway system. Kaiser took video and photos with her BlackBerry, got off at the 68th Street stop with the man still on the train, and later posted videos and photos on her blog. The post was picked up by Gothamist, a local blog network, and others. She said, I knew it would be a story people would want to hear. And by the way, I put a link on the website at thestufffile.com, which goes to a YouTube page which shows this man and his pet chicken on the subway. Has to be seen to be believed. Okay, we go to Scotland. A Scottish motorist who was ticketed for blowing his nose while his car was stopped in clogged traffic said he will take his charge to court. Michael Mancini, age 39, of Prestwick, said he was in a stationary traffic situation with his parking brake on when he reached for a handkerchief to wipe his runny nose, leading police constable Stuart Gray to issue him a $97 fine because he was, quote, not in control of his vehicle while blowing his nose. It's beyond a disgrace, Mancini said. Surely it would have been more dangerous to drive with a blocked nose? Mancini said he will not pay for the ticket and is now likely to face a criminal trial later this year. I'm really angry. I made sure it was safe to blow my nose. It's doubtful I'll get legal aid, so this could potentially cost me thousands of pounds in legal fees, he told the Daily Mail. But I won't be paying this fixed penalty. The constable, Constable Gray, previously made headlines last year when he issued an $80 littering ticket to a man who accidentally dropped a 10-pound note on the street. Okay, this cop's an idiot. He's close enough to making idiot of the day. But I've got a bigger idiot coming up later on, so this guy slides on by. But we'll keep our eye on Constable Stuart Gray because he made the news last year. He's made the news this year. I don't think he's done. Meanwhile, security screeners at the Bakersfield, California airport detained Francisco Ramirez, age 31, after they found suspicious bottles in his checked luggage. Security equipment signaled the bottles contained explosives. TSA officials tried a second test, which indicated different explosives. When they opened the bottles to get a closer look at the thick amber liquid inside, they became nauseated. All along, Ramirez assured them that the bottles just contained honey. He was visiting family and the heavily agricultural area and got some bottles to take home. Still, since it was just days after the underwear bomber incident, TSA officials sent two screeners to the hospital, called in hazardous materials experts, and the bomb squad diverted incoming flights and evacuated the terminal. After a massive investigation, analysis showed the mysterious goo was honey. Said a TSA spokeswoman, "I think this is an example of TSA working well with the airport, as well as with our partners in local law enforcement, to ensure that passengers remain safe at all times." No, dear. This is not a great example. This is gross overreaction. It's not an example of working well, and it comes right after gross underreaction, but it is typical of government response, don't you think? Meanwhile, let's go with substance misidentification number two. "I kept telling him it was candy," said Cesar Rodriguez. He was sitting in his work van with partner Jose Peña when a policeman found a plastic bag with a strange crystalline substance inside. "Crack cocaine," the officer said. "Coconut candy," Peña and Rodriguez said. The officer did no chemical test of the substance, but arrested them anyway. Peña was released after his arraignment 2 days later. 2 days later. But Rodriguez couldn't afford the $5,000 bail, so sat in jail until tests could be run. 5 days after his arrest, sure enough, the substance was crema de coco, a popular Mexican candy. "I spent 5 days in jail for possession of coconut candy," said Rodriguez. He and Peña planned to sue the city. You know, some cops have a nose for crime. Others might just try sniffing things once in a while. Creme de coco. That's what it was. Okay, Tyler Binghams, who was 18, turned down a college scholarship to sign with the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team, but Binghams was suspended for 50 games for twice testing positive for drug abuse. Days later, he was arrested after being pulled over in Estero, Florida, for speeding and weaving from one lane of traffic to another. Now, once he was pulled over, Binghams ran from the deputy and had to be tased into submission. A breath test showed his blood alcohol level was 0.234%. 234.234. I mentioned that number several times for a reason. In his debut season with the Cardinals farm team, he batted 216. You know, it takes a special talent for your blood alcohol level to beat out your National League batting average. A special kind of talent. His batting average was just above the Mendoza line. And finally, in the Stuff File program here, before we get to our next guest, Misty Shriver says she went to the Walmart store in Uniontown, Pennsylvania to meet her ex-boyfriend, who had just been released from a hospital, to give him money to pay for medication. She told police that when she offered $10 to Craig Owen David Jr., age 32, he grabbed $50 and took off. Now, he was easy to spot. He was still wearing his hospital gown, and he was also easy to catch, by the way. He was riding a mobility scooter that he had taken from the store. He was charged with robbery and disorderly conduct. And believe it or not, he's also not the idiot of the day. We'll get to that later. But let's get to our next guest right now. Star Wars creator George Lucas is like a bad boyfriend. He's constantly toying with fans' emotions. The filmmaker's long dysfunctional love-hate relationship with fans is the subject of Alexandre Philippe's documentary, The People vs. George Lucas, which is out this spring. Alexandre is on the line with us right now from Denver. Hi, Alexandre. How are you?
Hi, very good. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So, you have picked up, obviously, on what a lot of people feel when it comes to Star Wars and what George Lucas has done. What made you decide that you had to make this film?
Well, you know, I'm a big Star Wars fan. I want to say this right off the bat. And, you know, when you're a Star Wars fan and you find yourself in another room with another Star Wars fan, you know, you start talking about the things that you love and the things that you hate. And, of course, at the center of this discussion, of this debate, is always George Lucas. And so the title, essentially, really, this whole concept came to me with the title, the People versus George Lucas, because, there's so much, you know, what I call love-hate for the man. It's been going on for decades now, you know, especially obviously since the release of the special editions. And I just really felt very, very strongly that the film had to be made, a cultural examination of those feelings, where they come from, and, you know, in a sense, you know, how can we try to mediate this?
You know, I've often thought with art, because I've said this before, if Leonardo da Vinci had the opportunity to tinker with the Mona Lisa as much as George Lucas tinkered with Star Wars, I shudder to think what the woman would look like today.
Well, yes, and that's, you know, that's a big question, and that's certainly one of the debates that's very central to our film. You know, this notion of, you know, is it okay for an artist, you know, 20 years later to go back and change his art? I mean, that's one thing, but then for an artist to refuse to restore the original art that was embraced by, you know, world culture, that becomes a different issue. So that's definitely one of the most, you know, important points of the film. And, you know, I'm not going to give you any spoilers, but it gets pretty intense in the film.
So in your estimation, and generally speaking from people you talk to, what's the biggest sticking point, if there's any aspect in the film itself that people have a problem with?
You know, I think it really depends what, you know, type of fan you really talk to. You know, certainly the special editions and George's refusal to restore the original films is a big sticking point. But certainly you can look at, you know, the massive, massive disappointment from the original generation of fans at, you know, The Phantom Menace and the subsequent films, you know, feeling essentially that George changed some crucial elements. You know, you're talking about the midichlorians, you know, essentially sort of changing the Force, you know, changing the notion that they had built up in their head of what, you know, Darth Vader, you know, who he really was. So, you know, ultimately, I think a lot of it can be attributed to the fact that, you know, George waited, you know, 16 years to make another Star Wars movie. And in the meantime, the fans kept it alive. The fans, you know, continued to think about what Star Wars could be in their head. And, of course, it's never going to match. So, you know, I don't think there's any way that George could have made a film that would have really, truly pleased his original fan base.
So what you're saying then is that some people are kind of upset at the idea that maybe George Lucas is, in essence, trying to rewrite history?
Oh, absolutely, and that's definitely something that we have, you know, that we have in the film. I mean, it's definitely one of the themes, and one of the reasons why a lot of people are upset is this feeling, yes, absolutely, that he is rewriting history, and that he's not living up to, you know, his previous standards of greatness. I mean, of course, that's a completely subjective statement, but, you know, you can tell certainly from talking to hundreds of fans, you know, from you know, again, from the original generation, that's really the feeling. And, you know, and then you have the kids who love the new movies, who love the new Star Wars. So you also have this generational conflict, which is truly fascinating.
Is George Lucas aware of the fact that you are making this film The People versus George Lucas?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, Lucasfilm, we've been very open with them from day one. We even sent them an email essentially prior to launching our website back in late 2007. It's always been our intent to be very, very open about this. You know, we've invited them to participate. They have respectfully declined to participate. And quite frankly, that's okay. You know, we've got plenty of evidence from popular culture. I mean, we've really dug deep. I mean, we've traveled the world for 3 years. We've gone to Europe, to Canada, to Japan. You know, East Coast, West Coast. We've gotten, you know, submissions from around the world, and so we have all the evidence we need. But you know, we wanted to at least extend the invitation.
So he's aware of your existence. Are you in any way, shape, or form aware of how he feels about what you're doing?
Well, we don't. You know, George is very good at not showing you his feelings. I'm really hoping that they will see this film as a tribute more than anything. I want to, again, really make sure that people understand this is not a film against George Lucas. It's an examination of a cultural phenomenon of this love-hate. And so you know, we're really approaching this from the point of view of being, you know, documentary filmmakers. And we hope he likes it. I mean, we hope he sees it. We hope he likes it. But if he doesn't, you know, we have a story to tell, and that's the bottom line.
You mentioned that you travel the world talking to people about this whole Star Wars phenomenon and how people feel about George Lucas. Do the feelings differ from location to location, and maybe even from the political beliefs of a particular country that people might have as to how they feel about the Star Wars world?
Yes, I felt what was really interesting to me is talking specifically to people in Japan who just really don't understand how people in America or in, you know, really in the Western world, in Europe as well, can get so riled up about a creator and a series of films. And, you know, there's a lot more, you know, just straightforward respect and love for George Lucas in Japan, but you know, they kind of laugh, I guess, at the fact that people get so emotional about Star Wars.
Is there anything about the Star Wars saga that bothers you personally, Alexander?
Well, of course, you know, certainly. I mean, I'm a fanboy. You know, I'm from the original generation. You know, I'm 37 years old, so I was 5 years old when the original Star Wars came out. You know, just about every little boy of my generation at the time, you know, when Empire Strikes Back came out, it blew my mind, you know. And I have very much a lot of the same issues. You know, I feel that George really lost his way in terms of storytelling with Episode One. Very, very disappointed that he's not treating, you know, the original films in terms of film history with the respect that he should. There's no reason why those films should not be restored and released, you know, certainly on Blu-ray or at least an adequate format. So, you know, I have very much the same issues, and I have the same love, of course, and the same admiration for George. I mean, ultimately, the same feelings, although I don't like to call it hate, because I think that's a very strong word, but the same conflicted feelings that I have towards George are really what drove me essentially to, you know, drove me to make this film.
The website you mentioned earlier, which is www.peopleversusgeorge.com, besides promoting the film that you have coming out, what will the people find when they visit the website?
Well, you know, we're about to revamp our website right now because we're going to be making, on February 4th, we're going to be making the official announcement of our world premiere. All I can say, and unfortunately cannot make the announcement until that date, but all I can say is that it is a major film festival. It's going to be a very, very big premiere, and, you know, we're very excited. So, you know, the website is actually really cool. It's kind of a courtroom-style, you know, website. And, you know, originally it was built to encourage people to participate, but now the new focus of the website will be, you know, will be all the media surrounding the film, will be the world premiere, and, of course, you know, our brand-new trailer and all sorts of goodies, a new poster as well.
And when, you mentioned earlier that the film will be out in March, when exactly will people be able to find out and see the film?
Well, like I said, the announcement will be made on February 4th about the March world premiere. You know, after that, you know, all I can say right now is we have a number of festivals interested in following up. So, you know, we can expect a festival release, you know, probably around the world, you know, over the next, you know, few months and year, and then certainly we'll be getting into distribution talks after that. You know, our goal certainly is a theatrical release, followed, of course, by a, you know, DVD, Blu-ray after that.
Well, we look forward to it. The film is called The People vs. George Lucas, and you can check out the website again, which is peopleversusgeorge.com. Alexandre, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Alexandre Philippe, the maker of the film The People vs. George Lucas. Again, you can check out the website at www.peopleversusgeorge.com. And, of course, you can find the links by going to my website, thestufffile.com. This is the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Coming up in just a matter of moments, Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, Peter Anthony Holder once again brings you Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Lock up your daughters, and in West Virginia, your sheep. Joining Peter Anthony Holder is our intrepid embedded reporter, deep in the heartland of the U.S. of A., Stephen S. Walsh.
How you doing, Steve Areno?
Golly willikers, gee, I'm happy and cheerful and feeling so much better than I did a week ago.
Refresh my memory. What was wrong a week ago?
I had the...
Oh, yes.
I wasn't feeling well.
Yes, and people wanted to wanted you to be out of the office.
Yeah, they did.
More so than usual.
I nearly threw up on the lieutenant governor of the state of Missouri.
You nearly threw up on the lieutenant governor?
Well, I was in a committee hearing, and I was... feeling, you know, it starts to bubble up and you got to get out of there quickly.
Okay.
And I started making a beeline for the men's room, and as I did, the lieutenant governor was coming the other way in the hallway. He walked in front of me and said, "Hey, Walsh!" And he started talking about something. I said, "Oh!" And I ducked into the men's room just in time, I might add. Just in the nick of time.
Wow.
Yeah, that would have been a George Bush-esque incident.
Yes, it would have been, without the rice.
Yes, when he threw up in front of the Japanese prime minister. Oh, wait a minute. He didn't throw up in front of the Japanese prime minister. He threw up on the Japanese prime minister.
That's true. Well, we're glad you're feeling better, sir. We're glad you're feeling better.
I'm feeling great, yes.
Well, what do you have for us this week?
Okay, let's see. State line, St. Louis, Missouri.
That's the show me state.
It's where I live, by the way.
Yes, I know.
A St. Louis man who somehow lost track of a hefty stock holding is now $1.6 million richer. Compliments of the folks in Jefferson City who try to solve the problems of unclaimed assets. You know, you lose things where you've never found them. Your parents died, your grandparents, and you never claim the assets. Well, Missouri Treasurer Clint Zweifel, whose office manages the state's unclaimed assets fund, said the payment to the lucky guy is the biggest jackpot ever from this $600 million fund. Now, it holds assets on behalf of 3.5 million unaware people or households. That's quite a bit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Under Missouri law, businesses and governments that can't locate owners of unclaimed assets for 5 years must hand over the valuables to the state treasurer. Zweifel's office announced the $1.6 million payout to do a little crowing and to publicize the unclaimed asset system. Although the average unclaimed amount is worth $360, Zweifel said there are 30 accounts worth more than $100,000. Here's my question now. Can I get somebody else's identification?
No.
Doesn't work that way?
No.
Fine.
Okay.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Let's leave Missouri then.
Okay.
Dateline, Welch, Minnesota.
I'm sorry, did you say Walsh, Minnesota?
No. Welch, as in those grape people.
Oh, okay. That'd be the Gopher State.
Yeah, or Land of 10,000 Lakes, if you prefer.
Yes.
Emmett Pearson of Welch has been growing a beard for 36 years, a Super Bowl beard. Pearson's a farmer who loves the Minnesota Vikings. He watched the Vikings lose the 1975 Super Bowl to the Pittsburgh Steelers and immediately began growing a beard. The 79-year-old hasn't shaved since, and he doesn't plan to until the Vikings win the big game, whenever that might be. You know, this might have been the year, but the Vikings' overtime loss to the New Orleans Saints in the National Conference Championship game means it'll be at least another year before Razor meets face in Welch, Minnesota. Too bad.
Yeah.
Dateline, Liberal Kansas.
The Sunflower State.
Or the Jayhawk State.
Yes.
You probably didn't think there were too many liberals in Kansas.
No.
You know, in a most bizarre and gruesome case of murder-suicide, 36-year-old Jose Rodriguez, first suffocated his wife Alicia to death with a pillow. He then apparently felt terribly guilty about the whole thing because he whipped out a circular saw, cut off both of his legs, and then bled to death. This took place in the couple's bedroom. A note had been left for their two teenage children saying the couple had gone to Garden City. However, 4 days later, with no word from the couple, a missing persons report was filed. Police broke down the door to their home, and into the bedroom they found this terrible, terrible sight. Seriously, you know, one leg maybe, but how does one keep the presence of mind to saw off a second leg? I just couldn't do it, okay?
I was thinking the same thing.
I couldn't do it.
That's unbelievable.
I couldn't. Well, as if.
As if.
Dateline, Des Moines, Iowa.
That's the Hawkeye State.
Yes, it certainly is. It's my northern neighbor. The driver of a 1997 Audi told police in Des Moines that he was trying to scare a suicidal friend into wanting to live when he sped toward a light pole at a bend in the roadway. Damon Spartan of Des Moines said he told his friend he wanted to die too and pretended to be aiming for the light pole on Southwest 8th Street in Des Moines. Spartan lost control. He hit a curb and rolled the car. It came to rest off the roadway next to a utility pole. There were no serious injuries, fortunately. Damage to the car, by the way, estimated at $6,000. See, son, he might have been better off if he had actually, heaven forbid, if he'd succeeded.
Yeah.
This is kind of dumb, you know. Now I get charged with all kinds of offenses. Oh, some people are just so stupid. I'm telling you, they're just so stupid.
They
what
are.
Can I do?
They
it
are.
Would get me angry, but not yet. Dateline, West City, Illinois.
That'll be the land of Lincoln.
Yes, yes, yes. My next door neighbor. There are eight states that border Missouri, you know. A Catholic priest from Christopher, Illinois, was arrested on alleged shoplifting charges at the Walmart Supercenter in West City. The Reverend Stephen F. Poole, he's 41, by the way, he faces two counts of felony theft, over $150. He serves as priest for St. Andrew's Catholic Church in Christopher and St. Mary's Catholic Church in Cesar. Poole, who has a previous arrest for stealing right here in Missouri, was arrested after Walmart store surveillance video caught him on camera, failing to scan a $3.22 container of butter and a $60 sofa cover. Police said Poole then headed to the store's bedding department and picked up a memory foam mattress. He returned to the self-checkout lane where he was observed on tape switching the pricing barcode, causing the $144.88 item to be scanned for only $30.88. So when authorities stepped in, Poole was found to be in possession of a laptop computer power pack, also disappeared from the store. How about that, huh?
You know, I would get upset about when I hear stories about people of the cloth doing bad things, but looking at the items that he's put together, I don't want to go there, but looking at the items that he had in his shopping cart, one can draw a reference that I just don't want to touch. So let's just move on from that point, shall we?
Okay, we'll move on, because I'm angry. I'm angry.
Right.
I mean, allegedly I'm angry.
Yes.
Okay? And you know what happens to me, Peter, when I get angry?
What's
unlike most people, some people probably yell, they throw things, whatever. I don't do that. No, not me. No, I take keyboard in hand, and I write a two-minute tirade. And I have written one for this particular show right now, if I may.
Tirade away.
Okay, I want to take aim at reporters. I'm one of those reporters, but I don't use it as much as they do. They use the words, certain words, needlessly. Or should I say reporters allegedly use these words needlessly. Those of us involved in news and the spread of information, and I know you are as well, are constantly reminded of the need to make sure that we don't convict anyone before that person has indeed had his or her day in court. For instance, it is appropriate to say someone allegedly shot and killed another individual, or to say this person is suspected of shooting and killing another individual. But there are times when there is absolutely no need to be cautious with the use of words. For example, a reporter with one of our Missouri Net affiliates recently sent us an audio report from an ongoing criminal case that's making its way through the courts. In his report, he intended to tell us that the probable cause statement issued by prosecutors claimed the woman in the case had engaged in criminal activity. Instead, he told us that the probable cause statement issued by prosecutors allegedly claimed the woman in this case had engaged in criminal activity. Wrong. You know, if you're quoting or citing a legal document or an individual, you quote or cite the document or the person without adding words. You can say the suspect is alleged to have committed one crime or another, but when a prosecutor makes a statement, you do not get into legal trouble by quoting the prosecutor. The story is that the prosecutor claims an individual broke the law. Report what is said by the prosecutor. If you wish to use alleged, leave the prosecutor's comments or statements out of it. If you're quoting someone, don't add words. You're not taking a position and harming your objectivity by reporting what is on a document or by reporting what someone says. Don't add words needlessly. Just tell it as it is. I insist.
Those are the alleged words of the suspected Steve Walsh.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Yes.
And could you say those alleged three final words?
Sympathy!
This is The Stuff File.
And in just a moment, we have an idiot of the day, but first, more stuff right here, right now. Need some money for college? Well, there are a few unusual scholarships out there that you may not be aware of. For instance, Amber Ricci won the National Marbles Tournament Scholarship of $2,000 for shooting marbles. There's a $7,000 a year Lewis W. Davidson Bagpipe Memorial Scholarship, but you have to major in bagpipes. Then there's the $2,000 Sophie Major Memorial Duck Calling Scholarship if you want to and can win the duck calling contest. High school students who don't eat meat can win a $5,000 scholarship for promoting vegetarianism in their school or community. And finally, fans of Star Trek can win a $500 Starfleet Academy scholarship if they are active as a member of Starfleet. Oh, and the Klingon Language Institute awards a $500 Core Memorial Scholarship for language study. Fluency in Klingon is not required. Now, under the headline of Creme de la Weird, Russell Vanderwerf is 44, and he's an agent of the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Now, he was arrested in Louisiana in December and charged with damaging property while staying at the Residence Inn Hotel. According to police, Russell had removed the bedroom door of his suite and in its place installed a plywood plank which contained a hole at about pelvis level that had been rimmed with duct tape and which the arresting deputy said appeared to be used, quote, in some sort of sexual act. Another guest told police that numerous young men had been entering and exiting Russell's room. Okay, it's early yet, but we may already have the award winner for the bonehead move of the year. It happened in Australia when 43-year-old Guy Gardner tried to repair his broken cell phone with super glue. But just moments after applying the glue, the phone rang, and guess what? Guy answered it. He talked on the phone for about 5 minutes and only then realized it was now super glued to his ear. It crossed his mind to use his pocket knife to try to remove the phone, but then said, I realized I didn't want to see myself going to a doctor to put my ear back after I chopped it off. So he used a spoon. He managed eventually to pry the phone off and admitted, yes, it did hurt, but I guess I did hurt my pride much more than I hurt my ear. Okay, I know I've mentioned this on the old radio show before, but it bears repeating very briefly a story that I said earlier. One day my sister was ironing and the phone rang. Do I really need to finish that story? I don't think so. She's okay, by the way. Believe it or not, that story, nor my sister, makes the idiot of the day. This does.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the idiot of the day.
It was a dumb way to try to sneak drugs into prison. Pueblo County authorities said a 22-year-old woman worked out a plan with her boyfriend to get narcotics into jail through a courtroom exchange at her own sentencing hearing. Officials learned of the plot because the woman in jail, Felicia Trujillo, and her boyfriend talked about the plot on a monitored phone line. Phil Martinez, age 26, allegedly dropped a bag of narcotics in the jury box before Felicia's hearing when the courtroom was empty. The alleged drug drop happened minutes after elementary school students had finished a mock trial in the very same courtroom. Detectives were watching and Martinez was arrested. Both Martinez and Felicia face drug and contraband charges. Now, Felicia and Phil, the idea that you were trying to do a drug drop in a courtroom after putting the plot together on a monitored telephone because one of you was in jail, do I have to say it? Both of you are idiots.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of The Stuff File with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Hope you've enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's S-T-U-P-H, thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding number and date. And the number for this program is number 0024. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder and on Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. We hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including cyberstationusa.com and World FM 88.5 FM in New Zealand. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.